us to reality. In 1868, Nast went after William Boss Tweed, the undisputed master of New York politics, always drawing Tweed and his associates as a flock of vultures on the prowl. At one point, Tweed dispatched some of his cronies on a mission. "Stop them damn pictures. I don't care what the papers write about me. My constituents can't read, but damn it, they can see the pictures." The Tweed ring collapsed the following year. Grant attributed his 1868 presidential election to the sword of Sheridan and the pencil of Nast. The artist's ridicule of Horace Greeley in 1872 was merciless. In political battles, a common sentiment among voters was, "Let's wait and see what Tommy Nast thinks of it." Nast embarked on a nationwide tour as a lecturer and sketch artist and returned a wealthy man. Photographs show a smiling, good-humored fellow, in sharp contrast to the savage attacks in his cartoons. As in the case of Rembrandt, Nast enjoyed self-portraits, yet they were unpretentious, if not outright comical. In the 1876 presidential campaign, Rutherford Hayes called Nast the most powerful single-handed aide in his victory. However, Nast broke with Hayes over the president's conciliatory gestures to the South. At the same time, the new owners of Harper's Weekly stopped buying as many cartoons from Nast. As it happens, the magazine's greatest years had been Nast's greatest years as well. He switched to the Democratic Party in 1884 and helped Grover Cleveland gain the presidency. The artist then lost most of his assets in a banking firm scandal. He made another cross-country tour, but many readers in a more relaxed America considered his sketches outdated. Moreover, years of drawing had left his arthritic hand in constant pain. Nearly destitute by 1902, Nast sought government employment abroad. He wanted to return to Germany, but Theodore Roosevelt named him Consul General to Ecuador. Nast arrived there just as an outbreak of yellow fever swept the country. He contracted the disease and died December 7, 1902. He is buried in Woodlawn Cemetery in New York City. Nast's contributions to the American heritage are unprecedented. No other American cartoonist has ever made such a lasting impact on the public. He will always be the father of American political cartoons. Modern illustrations on editorial pages are outgrowths of the seeds he planted. Nast bequeathed the Democratic Donkey, Republican Elephant, Uncle Sam, and Columbia, as well as personification of dirty politics, Tammany Tiger. Yet, to old and young alike, he is best remembered as the man who made Santa Claus. Alfred Rudolph Woad, Sketches from the Front Lines. In 1864, a London Daily Telegraph correspondent traveling with the Union Army of the Potomac filed a long dispatch to his newspaper. At one point, he stated, "There has galloped furiously by us, backward and forward, during our journey, a tall man mounted on a taller horse, blue-eyed, fair-bearded, strapping and stalwart, full of loud, cheery laughs and comic songs, armed to the teeth, jack-booted, gauntleted, slouched-hatted, yet clad in the shooting jacket of a civilian. He didn't look like an American. He was too well-dressed to be a guerrilla." The British reporter was describing Alfred Rudolph Woad, the most productive battlefield artist of the Civil War. Often working under fire, he was able to record the action and the excitement of combat with an immediacy denied to Matthew Brady and other photographers. The quantity of his sketches was extraordinary. So was the quality of what he drew. Born in London in 1828, Alf Woad began studying art at an early age. He came to America in 1850 because he had a sentimental liking for Republican institutions. He worked at various jobs in New York City before moving to Boston, where he learned to draw on woodblocks for engravers. the most common method by which a drawing could be reproduced on paper stock for mass circulation. He also began making scenic sketches, mostly of city life. In time, he hoped to become a marine painter and made at least one oil painting of ships anchored in New York City. On May 4, 1861, Woad agreed to become a special artist for the New York Illustrated News and made his way to Washington. His first Civil War image was of Colonel Elmer Ellsworth's New York Zouaves battling a blaze at Willard's Hotel. He was one of two artists allowed to accompany the Union Army to Manassas, where he did several drawings of the war's opening battle, notably one of an artillery battery moving into position. This was his initiation into 4 years of combat and military artwork, and the heaviest detail of his drawings set Woad apart from the usual sketchers. After Manassas, while General George McClellan built a new army, Woad joined a Union expedition to Forts Hatteras and Clark on the North Carolina coast. Unfortunately, only two sketches of the campaign have survived. Back in Virginia, Woad drew scenes of Fort Monroe and Newport News for a double-page spread that is stunning in its detail. Along with his sketches, the artist wrote personal accounts of military affairs for the New York newspaper. He was pro-Union in sentiment and usually referred to Confederates in such terms as rabble and devilish gray coats. As with his sketches, Woad's written dispatches to newspapers focused more on individuals and their activities than on statistics, troop movements, and other inanimate subjects. Woad won national acclaim in the late summer of 1861 for what is considered to be the largest wood engraving ever produced in America. The Grand Review of the Army of 70,000 Troops of the Army of the Potomac by George B. McClellan. It folded into five sections in the newspaper. That illustration led to Woad's joining the staff of Harper's Weekly, an association that lasted for 19 years. His first illustration for his new employer was a White House reception. By then, his technique was firmly in place. He would rush a sketch to the New York office by mail or courier. Engravers would laboriously copy the drawing on boxwood blocks. Once finished, the blocks would be bolted together to form a completed picture for the printing press. As many as 40 blocks were used for a double-page spread. The journey from sketch to print took 3 to 4 weeks. Naturally, the woodblocks failed to do full justice to the submitted sketch. Woad intensely disliked fellow Harper's Weekly artist Thomas Nast because Woad claimed that the cartoonist tampered with his sketches when they arrived in New York and sometimes passed them off as his own creations. Nast vigorously denied these accusations. In contrast, Woad seemed to make friends easily throughout the Union Army. Captain Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr. informed his family that Woad was quite a truthful draftsman. The Army's Chief of Staff, Colonel Theodore Lyman, wrote this in his diary in May 1864. "Friend Woad is along with us still and sojourns with the engineers. He draws very good sketches, and very poor woodcuts they make thereof. His indignation has long since given place to sarcasm, for W. is a merry and philosophic bohemian." Woad found himself on one occasion detained behind enemy lines. During his brief capture, he did a sketch of men in the 1st Virginia Cavalry with a Confederate battle flag as the center of the drawing. The most famous of several wartime photographs of Woad shows him sketching while seated atop a boulder in Devil's Den at Gettysburg. The 35-year-old Woad also made the only eyewitness drawing of Pickett's charge, the climactic assault of the three-day battle. He appeared oblivious to danger. An 1864 news item from Petersburg, Virginia, told of Woad coolly making his sketches under fire whilst the enemy bullets were kicking up little columns of dust on the ground around him. His numerous adventures and narrow escapes would fill a volume. No correspondent was allowed to attend the April 9, 1865 surrender conference at Appomattox. Yet Wode was outside the home and drew a hasty sketch of General Robert E. Lee starting the ride back to his defeated army. His sketch later that day of Federal soldiers sharing rations with starving Southern infantry is a poignant one. Wode also accompanied the Lincoln funeral train on the long journey to Springfield, Illinois. Those sad illustrations were the capstone of 344 sketches he made during the Civil War. Harper's Weekly then sent Wode to record life in the defeated South. He sketched a fire in a Louisville opera house, found Cairo, Illinois, to be nothing but dust, filth, and intrusive drinking saloons, thought Memphis the worst-behaved city in the Union, and adjudged Vicksburg to be in the hands of foreigners, the police being among the worst specimens. Wode made a permanent picture of U.S. Grant's inauguration and captured part of the wrath of the Great Chicago Fire in 1871. The largest collection of printed Wode drawings were incorporated in Battles and Leaders of the Civil War, a four-volume work published during 1884 through 87. His busy life ended at the age of 62. Wode died on April 6, 1891, of heart failure while visiting a friend in Marietta, Georgia, where he is buried in the Episcopal Cemetery. Wode led the procession of newspaper artists who witnessed and recorded scenes of the Civil War, the Reconstruction, and the growing Union of the divided states. To untold thousands of Americans, the scenes of Alf Wode were their eyes to the past, present, and future. Moses Ezekiel, the sculptor who never forgot. Though Moses Ezekiel was only a teenage cadet in the final years of the Civil War, the North-South conflict was the springboard that elevated him to international fame as a sculptor whose creations are memorials of the war. Ezekiel was the seventh of 14 children born to a family in a poverty-stricken neighborhood in Richmond, Virginia. His grandparents raised him to ease the pressure of so many youngsters in the Ezekiel household. On September 17, 1862, the day of the Battle of Antietam, the 17-year-old became the first Jewish applicant admitted to the Virginia Military Institute, VMI, at Lexington. He was a good cadet, but not a good-looking one. A brother rat, as freshmen are dubbed, later testified that Ezekiel never could chisel himself into a pretty soldier. His head was as large as a brownie's, his body thick-set, and his legs were very short. In fact, he looked like a tin soldier that had been broken in the middle and mended with sealing wax. Given the open anti-Semitism of that age, Ezekiel had to obtain permission from the Board of Governors to return home for the observance of Jewish holidays such as Passover. As though to underscore his difference from his fellows, his roommate was Thomas Jefferson Garand, a direct descendant of the man who had framed the Declaration of Independence. One memory of VMI that Ezekiel did cherish was being corporal of the guard that stood watch over General Stonewall Jackson's coffin through the night before the former professor's burial. In May 1864, Ezekiel was among the 257 cadets who marched 89 miles down the Shenandoah Valley to confront a Union army at New Market. Ankle-deep mud sucked the shoes off the charging teenagers. Ezekiel replaced his with a pair of boots taken from a dead Federal soldier. The green soldier had the unenviable task of caring for his mortally wounded roommate until his death 3 days later. VMI cadets spent the last months of the war training the handful of recruits who came forth. When Ezekiel returned to VMI for his final year of study, General Robert E. Lee recognized Ezekiel's talents and encouraged him to pursue an artistic calling. Ezekiel spent a year studying anatomy at the University of Virginia and then journeyed to Europe with hopes of becoming a sculptor. For a time, he supported himself by serving as a correspondent during the Franco-Prussian War. His real break came when he was admitted to the Berlin Royal Academy of Art, where Albert Wolff, sculptor of the German royal family, became his mentor. Ezekiel's first plaster, Virginia Mourning Her Dead, was completed in Berlin. Now, the most hallowed symbol at VMI, it faces the drill field. In front of the sculpture are the graves of six of Ezekiel's fellow cadets who were killed at Newmarket. Ezekiel himself describes his creation. The chainmail-clad figure is seated mourning upon a piece of breastwork, and her foot rests upon a broken cannon overgrown with ivy, and she holds a reversed lance in her hand. Ezekiel moved to Rome, where he lived for the next 30 years. In his studio, located in the ancient baths of Diocletian, he created more than 200 sculptures. His fame swept around the world. One set, consisting of 11 larger-than-life statues of famous artists, was installed in the Corcoran Gallery of Art. Among so many others, Robert E. Lee, Stonewall Jackson, and Thomas Jefferson were subjects for Ezekiel's creations. He even molded a tribute to dead soldiers at Johnson's Island Prison in Ohio. Ezekiel divided his sculptures into three categories: works devoted to the Confederate cause, heroic poses, and religious subjects. His Rome studio, in the words of one admirer, was a stupendous spectacle, strewn with the mighty monuments of the past, a wilderness from which nothing springs but grass, fever germs, and noble thoughts. The place became a must-see for American tourists. U.S. Grant, Mark Twain, John D. Rockefeller, and Theodore Roosevelt were among those who came to pay homage. By the end of the century, the sculptor had received commendations from 4 European heads of state, plus dozens of high awards from America. Uncle Mosey, as family members affectionately called their bachelor kinsman, made periodic visits to the United States. His last trip, in 1910, was to dedicate the Jackson statue on the State House grounds at Charleston, West Virginia. He learned that the federal government had recently agreed to set aside a portion of Arlington National Cemetery for Confederate casualties and expressed strong interest in the movement. Back in Rome, he spent 7 years creating a huge, intricate monument. World War I slowed his production. Dampness and lack of coal in wintertime forced Ezekiel to close his Rome studio. He volunteered to assist the Red Cross Relief Agency by becoming an Italian ambulance driver. Fatigue and exposure led to pneumonia, and on March 27, 1917, Ezekiel died. One of his final wishes was to be buried with his Confederate comrades at Arlington. The European War delayed the return of his remains to America, and his burial did not occur until March 31, 1921. It was the first funeral service held in the large Arlington Amphitheater, where formal ceremonies are now conducted regularly. Ezekiel's gravestone, at the base of the soaring monument he sculpted, could have displayed for eternity some of his great statues or international awards or eminence in his field. Instead, the marker proclaims, "Moses J. Ezekiel, Sergeant of Company C, Battalion of Cadets of the Virginia Military Institute." George Frederick Root, Songs of the Civil War. If any American deserves the title Musician of the People, it is unquestionably George Frederick Root of Massachusetts. Born with a talent for music, he could play 13 instruments by the age of 12. His first job was with a Boston piano instructor who introduced music curricula in local schools. Root pursued a career as a music teacher in elementary schools and professional institutions, including at the New York Institute for the Blind. There, he and Fanny Crosby, a lyricist, collaborated on numerous popular secular songs. He also wrote gospel music while collecting and editing volumes of choral tunes. After a trip to Europe to study musical trends and styles, Root gained a national reputation by participating in musical convocations. In 1859, he joined his brother's music company in Chicago. When not writing music or helping to manage the company, he continued to travel and lecture at various musical festivals. Sheet music by then had become all the rage, and Root contributed weekly to the output. The advent of war in 1861 brought out Root's leading assets: knowledge of instrumental music, improvisational skills, and absolute devotion to his country. A week after the bombardment of Fort Sumter and the beginning of war, Root published, "The First Gun Is Fired, May God Protect the Right." Next came a call to duty: "Stand up for Uncle Sam, my boys." In all his compositions, Root tapped into the emotions of soldiers and their families, expressing hope, grief, and inspiration that was individual and personal while sharing a widespread experience. In April 1862, Root was reclining in a lounge chair at his brother's home when a song formed in his mind. He thought about it all afternoon, then drafted it on sheet music paper the next morning. No other melody so stirred Union soldiers as did "The Battle Cry of Freedom." The tune was easy to sing, and the lyrics were inspiring. "Yes, we'll rally round the flag, boys, we'll rally once again. Shouting the battle cry of freedom, we will rally from the hillside, we will rally from the plain, shouting the battle cry of freedom." The composition was a favorite throughout the war years and beyond. More than 350,000 copies of sheet music were sold in its first year. One Billy Yank asserted that "Battle Cry" put as much spirit and cheer into the army as a splendid victory. Root himself confessed, "The song went into the army, and the testimony in regard to its use in the camp and on the march and even in the field of battle made me thankful that if I could not shoulder a musket in defense of my country, I could serve her in this way." One story that always touched Root concerned an Iowa regiment that made a charge at Vicksburg, Mississippi, and lost 50% of its strength in the fighting. The survivors retired from the field singing "The Battle Cry of Freedom." Many of Root's wartime tunes may sound maudlin and melodramatic to modern ears, yet they touch the souls of the Civil War generation. "The Prisoner's Hope," also known for its chorus line, "Tramp, tramp, tramp," offered hope to Union prisoners of war. "Just Before the Battle, Mother," was a mixture of fear and determination by a young soldier uncertain of his future. "The Vacant Chair" spoke of the empty place at the dinner table left by the death in some faraway place of a father or a brother. Root once explained his musical approach this way: "When anything happened that could be voiced in a song, or when the heart of the nation was moved by particular circumstances caused by the war, I wrote what I thought would then express the emotions of the soldiers or the people." Prosperity allowed Root to move his Chicago location in 1863 to a site four times larger. In all, he contributed 35 songs to the war effort. He gained national recognition and the appreciation of every Northern soldier who sang or understood music. After the end of hostilities, a Confederate officer told his former enemies, "Gentlemen, if we had your songs, we'd have whipped you out of your boots." Root was the most prolific composer of the Civil War. He rode that fame well into the post-war years by climbing aboard various bandwagons. Strong supporter of the temperance movement, he applied new lyrics to some of his Civil War tunes. "Just Before the Battle, Mother" was reissued with new verses as "Promise Me." The soldier song "Kingdom Coming" appeared as "The Temperance Sheep." For U.S. Grant's 1868 presidential bid, Root even changed the battle cry of freedom to "The Ballot Box of Freedom." Turning to hymns, Root made similar transitions. "The Prisoner's Hope" reappeared as "Jesus Loves the Little Children," while "The Vacant Chair" became "Life's Railway to Heaven." Root remained the nation's preeminent composer until the appearance in World War I of George M. Cohan. At one point, Root fell seriously ill, whereupon his physician diagnosed a condition of the brain. A friend suggested weightlifting, and Root's health returned to normal. The 1871 Chicago fire destroyed all his company's sheet music, but plates and copyrights survived. A year later, the University of Chicago bestowed on Root a Doctor of Music degree. He soon turned to writing cantatas and produced 28 in all. Decades before Walt Disney's Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, Root and his daughter composed an operetta based on the same story. In 1891, Root commented, "I cannot imagine a pleasanter life for myself than the one I now live." 4 years later, on August 6, 1895, while going through a normal workday at his Bailey Island, Maine home, Root died of a heart attack. He was buried in North Reading, Massachusetts. The following year, 20,000 people gathered in Chicago's Coliseum for a festival to benefit the George F. Root Monument Fund. Never was the battle cry of freedom sung with greater fervor. The composer idolized music. "It is an interesting fact," he observed, "that some music, at every grade from lowest to highest, has in it that mysterious quality which makes it live, while all the rest fades away and is forgotten." George Root died content. In the nation's darkest hour, he had contributed magnificently to the spirits of the brave men marching into battle. Louisa May Alcott, Resilience in Writing. No American writer benefited more, while suffering more, from the Civil War than Louisa May Alcott. Though she was a nurse, she herself became ill, and the cure proved worse than the disease. She suffered from mercury poisoning throughout the years of writing her finest books. In her case, war truly was the crucible of her works. Born in a Philadelphia suburb of Germantown to Amos Bronson Alcott, an educator, and Abigail May Alcott, a social worker, Louisa spent her early life in near poverty and discouragement. After the family moved to Boston, she got her formal education from a father who stopped working in 1839 to contemplate and speak on the sweetness of self-denial. The Alcotts pursued transcendentalism, the credo that one can gain perfection through better spiritualism. This brought friendship with such established writers as Henry David Thoreau, Ralph Waldo Emerson, and Nathaniel Hawthorne. Her family's limited means forced Alcott to spend her teenage years as an occasional teacher, seamstress, and governess. In her spare time, she tried her hand at writing, which became a creative challenge as well as an emotional outlet for her unhappiness. Soon, she published her first book, Flower Fables, 1849, and the first of her many short stories that would appear in The Atlantic Monthly. The family struggled throughout the 1850s, and at one point in 1857, Louisa contemplated suicide. Neighbors soon converted the impressionable feminist to the abolitionist cause. The Alcott family became station agents for the Underground Railroad, helping runaway slaves to freedom. Late in 1859, Alcott wrote a poem, "With a Rose That Bloomed on the Day of John Brown's Execution," and she referred to the abolitionist as Saint John the Just. In her late 20s, when the Civil War began, Alcott was tall and broad-shouldered with dark eyes and hair. Her first work in the conflict was to sew uniforms and to act in theatricals for the humanitarian U.S. Sanitary Commission. She desired a more fulfilling position, and for 6 weeks in 1861 to 62, served as a volunteer nurse in one of Washington's military hospitals. The 12-hour shifts exhausted her physically and mentally. An attack of typhoid fever ended her nursing duties and almost her life. Physicians plied her with calomel, a widely used purgative laced with mercury. Overdoses produced mercury poisoning, which, among other negative side effects, causes slow deterioration of the nervous system. Alcott was near death when she reached home, and she remained a semi-invalid for the rest of her life. Her arms and legs ached, forcing her to frequently stand up from her writing table and walk around in an effort to stretch the discomfort from her limbs. Her first post-war literary endeavor came with editing letters she had sent home while a nurse. The correspondence appeared in print under the title Hospital Sketches. Alcott freely described the filth and mismanagement of Army hospitals, as well as the indifference of many surgeons. The next year she wrote a short story for children, Nellie's Children, which related the experiences of a little girl who was moved by the wartime wounding of her brother to create a hospital for all the sick animals in her neighborhood. A novel, Moods, 1865, followed the success of Sketches and went into more detail about her war experiences. Another fictional work, On Picket Duty and Other Tales, 1866, was also set in the Civil War. Under the pseudonym A.B. Barnard, the crippled Alcott stepped out of character and wrote two well-received novels of passion, A Long Fatal Love Chase, 1866, and Pauline's Passion and Punishment, 1868. She was 35 and graying when a New York publisher approached her to do a girl's story. The offer meant returning to her childhood, which she did not want to do, but it was an opportunity to earn money. And given that she'd grown up with three loving sisters, the writing assignment was easy. Alcott wrote continually and without excitement for 2.5 months. The result was Little Women, 1868, her most famous book. It is a moving account of four sisters whose comfortable lives are disrupted by their father's absence in the war. She explained the base of her novel with the statement, "Very few letters written in those hard times were more touching, especially those which fathers sent home." Little Women, which parallels Charles Dickens's novels in which every character is a caricature of some virtue or vice, has had an astounding ability to touch the hearts of readers and has never been out of print. Alcott wrote two sequels, Little Men, 1868, and Joe's Boys, 1884. Her 33 books and essays made her the most famous female writer of her day. Pale and serious, dressed always in black or dark brown, she wrote at a steady pace. Her right hand eventually became cramped from overuse, whereupon she learned to write with her left. Alcott never married. "I am more than half persuaded," she once confessed, "that I am a man's soul put by some freak of nature into a woman's body." In 1882, a stroke paralyzed the father she adored, and she became his constant companion as her own health deteriorated. She suffered from severe rheumatoid pain, trembling, irritability, and weakness. She wrote to a friend, "The wartime hospital experience was a costly one for me. Never well since." She was 55 when she died of a stroke, 2 days after the passing of her father. It is traditionally believed that she died from the long-term effects of mercury poisoning. Revisionist theories of late attribute her death to autoimmune disease or spinal meningitis. Alcott was buried in Sleepy Hollow Cemetery in Concord, Massachusetts, near some of the great writers who had given her early encouragement. One of her many biographers made this summation: "Her anxious and unhappy girlhood turned in the Civil War, and though physically stricken, she thereafter gained financial support and a source of both justification and satisfaction." Walt Whitman, America's Poet Laureate. In the first half of the 19th century, America was print mad. Into the mainstream of that flood of ink appeared the works of Walt Whitman, whom one literary scholar has characterized as the self-anointed poet of democracy, arguing for the dignity and meaning of ordinary labor. Whitman endured ridicule and neglect in his early poetic endeavors, and his dismissal of conventional patterns of rhyme and meter drew early criticism worldwide. Praise came only in his older years, and today he is regarded throughout the literary world as the father of free verse. Born to a Brooklyn housebuilder in 1819, Whitman followed Benjamin Franklin's trail into the printing business. The self-taught youth loved the printed word and read voraciously. In 1841, after a 5-year tenure as a teacher, Whitman turned to journalism as a full-time career. He edited a number of weekly papers in New York. A brief stint with a New Orleans periodical gave him a first-hand view of slavery's evils. Meanwhile, he was developing an unorthodox style of poetry. His first collection of poems, Leaves of Grass, 1855, contains a preface and 12 untitled poems, mostly lacking punctuation. The verses are filled with stories of the virtues and vices of common people, the wildest players in American life, one critic snorted. Some literary analysts have suggested that in Leaves of Grass, Whitman came to terms with his homosexuality, then known as free love. With an endorsement from Ralph Waldo Emerson, Whitman released a second edition of Leaves in 1856, which had 33 poems, almost triple those in the first printing. Many reviewers denounced the collection for its blatant expressions of immorality. Others praised Whitman as a great spokesman for brotherhood and equality. Human rights activist and former slave Sojourner Truth was so taken by Whitman's lines that she said the poems were messages from God. Whitman spent the first stages of the Civil War as a freelance journalist and occasional volunteer in New York City area military hospitals. In December 1862, he learned that his brother George had been seriously wounded at the Battle of Fredericksburg, and he hastened to Washington. He found his sibling only slightly injured, yet Whitman was shocked by the endless wagon trains bringing wounded soldiers to hospitals already crowded beyond capacity. "It is the most pitiful sight, I think, when first the men are brought in," he wrote to his mother. "I have to hustle around to keep from crying." Whitman immediately decided to become a nurse, traveling among Washington's 40 soldier hospitals. His nursing duties were usually noon to 4 p.m. and 6 to 9 p.m., mostly in Armory Square Hospital, which had the most injured patients. He obtained a part-time job in the paymaster's department and supplemented his small salary by writing occasional war stories for newspapers. In his early 40s, tall, good-looking, with clear blue eyes and an unhurried air, Whitman always wore bohemian-style clothing and was a welcome sight and instant friend to everyone he met. He came to know an extraordinary number of patients. During his 3 years of nursing, Whitman made an estimated 600 visits to as many as 80,000 incapacitated soldiers. As he viewed the human suffering from battle and disease, he became convinced that future years will never know the seething hell and the bleak infernal background of minor scenes and interiors of the Secession War, and it is best they should not. The real war will never get in the books. Whitman's residency in the Capitol gave him opportunity to witness Abraham Lincoln personally and politically. He came to see the great emancipator as the all-seeking being the poet had long searched for. Lincoln's death in 1865 was, for Whitman, a grand tragedy that promised ultimate reunification for America. Two of his best-known poems appeared as eulogies. "O Captain, My Captain" is a melodramatic poem in conventional rhyme and meter about a ship captain bravely guiding his vessel through a terrible storm. In "When Lilacs Last in the Dooryard Bloomed," Whitman returned to free-flowing lines. Three images appear: the Western Star, Lincoln, a singing thrush, Whitman, and a lilac bush, the eulogistic poem. They interweave with meditations on the Civil War and death. Yet his 3 years of hospital labor had taken a heavy toll. "I had to give up my health for it, my body, the vitality of my physical self," he stated. "Oh, so much had to go." he took a job in the Department of the Interior and published a third enlarged edition of Leaves of Grass in 1865. Secretary of the Interior James Harlan thereupon fired the poet for his scandalous writings. Whitman struggled to support himself by writing poetry full-time. In the next quarter century, he composed 194 poems, and at least 115 were published. Typically, when composing, he would tilt his big rocking chair back against a table and write with a mammoth quill pen as he held a pad on his knee. His followers regarded him as the nation's literary savior. His critics, Henry James notable among them, never accepted his views or writing style. Another further enlarged edition of Leaves of Grass brought renewed praise and criticism. Whitman moved to Camden, New Jersey, to be near his brother and dying mother. In January 1873, he suffered a stroke that restricted the use of his left arm and leg. Recurring bouts of dizziness, vomiting, faintness, and slow locomotion further hampered his activities, and physicians were unable to ascertain a cause. More and more he confronted in verse the meaning of the Civil War, his homosexuality, religion, the afterlife, and his place in culture. Toward the end, his once robust frame was slumped in a wheelchair. A series of mini-strokes, whacks, as he called them, increased his paralysis. His body, wasted, atrophied, and abscessed, became a carnival ground of decay, a visitor noted. Whitman lived out his life in squalor. Death came March 26, 1892. Pathologists list the causes as pleurisy of the left side, consumption in the right lung, general military tuberculosis, and parenchymatous nephritis. Whitman was buried in Camden's Harley Cemetery in a mausoleum whose construction he had overseen. One authority wrote this summation: "No writer is regarded as more indisputably American than Whitman. Yet no writer has reverberated on the international scene to the extent that he has. He was the democratic poet to an extent never heretofore recognized, gathering images from virtually every cultural arena and transforming them through his powerful personality into art." Chapter 5. Westward Ho! The final echoes of the Civil War had barely faded into the distance when the nation's attention turned westward to the unspoiled Great West. This rough square of land measured about 1,000 miles on each side. Plains, mountains, plateaus, and deserts lay for the taking. The region's only occupants were Native Americans and buffalo. By 1890, the entire area was carved into 10 states and 4 territories. Men flung themselves greedily on this enormous prize as if to ravish it, one historian stated. Never before in human experience had so huge an area been reduced so rapidly to a semblance of civilization. This overnight transformation was the result of 2 factors: completing a transcontinental railroad and eliminating native tribes standing in the way of white settlement. In the 1850s, a rash of local companies had laid pieces of a rail network all along the eastern seaboard and the upper Mississippi Valley. The feverish years after the Civil War witnessed an unparalleled outburst of railroad construction. What had been 30,000 miles of track in wartime became 192,500 miles at century's end. American railroads eclipsed all of Europe's tracks combined. The chief underwriter of the transcontinental line was the federal government. Only it had the necessary funds and executive power. Yet it took good men with firm determination to make the dream become reality. Grenville Dodge was the principal surveyor of the Union Pacific Railroad, which built 2/3 of the Transcontinental Railroad. His route selections remain one of the wonders of modern railroading. The coming of the Iron Horse changed virtually worthless land into valuable real estate linked in a chain of progress by rail tracks. Overlooked acreage became prosperous fields for a variety of crops. Frontier villages matured quickly into flourishing cities. A railroad took the farmer to his newly claimed land, carried the fruits of his toil to market, and brought him manufactured necessities. Standing in the way of such progress were the original settlers of the West, Native American tribes. In the northern half of the region were principally the Sioux and Cheyenne. In the south were Comanche and Apache. As the railroads and more settlers approached in a tidal wave, the indigenous tribes found no solace. Solemn promises made by the government were broken. Agents were corrupt. Too many settlers treated tribes as unwanted animals. Murder, looting, and debauchery were common. All too soon, these tribes found themselves fighting for survival. During the period from 1868 to 1890, the federal government engaged in almost incessant warfare from the Canadian to the Mexican borders. A printed list of the names of the engagements covers 100 pages. The fighting was fierce, with neither side inclined to take prisoners. The operations eventually led to ruthless subjugation of Native Americans and removal of the survivors to unwanted lands called reservations. This period of extermination remains one of America's most embarrassing. On this new type of battlefield, the early efforts of the Federal Army were uneven. George Custer, known for being impetuous during the war, remained blindly unaware of the tactics his native foes used, including a reliance on deception. He rushed his men into a trap so disastrous that the battle at Little Bighorn has become legendary. Far more stable was Winfield Hancock. One of the most proficient generals during the war, he too saw action on the plains. Only in his case, he proved too magnanimous to the Native Americans for the liking of the more bloody-minded Republican Congress. He was reassigned so that the removal process could proceed apace. Into the breach rushed Philip Sheridan. The short, ill-tempered hero of the Union cavalry became famous during the war for his scorched-earth policy that laid ruin to the Shenandoah Valley. He then turned his fierce disposition on a series of Western tribes, and his tactics against them amounted to wholesale slaughter of warriors and civilians alike. Under his direction, the Cheyenne, Kiowa, Comanche, and Apache were brutally brought to heel. Throughout the process of clearing the West, white settlers established the first towns and villages to resemble what they had left behind. The rawness of these outposts opened the way for all sorts of colorful characters, whether those breaking the law or upholding it. One Union officer, the leader of the ill-fated Irish Brigade, attempted to use the fear of Native Americans for his own personal and political gain. The story of Thomas Francis Marr, who came to the Montana Territory to lay down his drunken decrees, strained the meaning of the word governor to its limits. Wild Bill Hickok is a more familiar hero who migrated west. He fought for the Union in Missouri, and after the war, he brought his murderous brand of law enforcement to the unfortunate frontier towns that hired him. In an era when might often made right, Hickok was unique, even for the Wild West. Grenville Mellon Dodge, laying the tracks for expansion. Jay Gould owned the Union Pacific Railroad, but the man most responsible for its creation was Massachusetts native Grenville Mellon Dodge. A Union general under Grant in war, and a confidant of Sherman in peace, Dodge lived longer and had a more active and varied life than any other prominent general in the Civil War. Indeed, his work on America's first transcontinental railroad outshines any of his fighting. After graduating from Norwich University, Dodge put his civil engineering studies to practice by moving to Council Bluffs, Iowa, and surveying for the infant Union Pacific Railroad. With the onset of the Civil War, he began as a colonel of the 4th Iowa and advanced steadily through the Army's chain of command. While stationed in Missouri, Dodge organized an intelligence service to gain information on enemy movements. His 100-man corps of scouts was the largest intelligence-gathering body in the war, and the agents were so effective that their names still remain unknown today. In late 1862, at Grant's request, Dodge rebuilt a vital rail line connecting Nashville, Tennessee, with Decatur, Alabama. He rose to the rank of Major General after being cited for gallantry during the campaign for Atlanta. With a full head of hair parted on the side and a bushy mustache and eyebrows, Dodge stood 5 feet 8 inches tall and weighed only 125 pounds. He was an energetic man, nervous and high-strung. He spoke and wrote as if he could barely wait to finish his tasks. At the end of the Civil War, Dodge's Department of the Missouri was expanded to include Kansas, Nebraska, and Utah. When Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes began raiding Bozeman Trail and other mail routes, Grant ordered Dodge, who had a strong bias against Native Americans, to end the nuisances. "They must be relentlessly pursued and eliminated," Dodge felt, saying, "The Indian character is such that he will not stand continual following, pounding, and attacking." He thought peace treaties not worth the paper they are written on. Yet Washington authorities preferred an uneasy paper peace. Dodge always believed that if he had been allowed to punish the tribe severely, we would have conquered a peace that would have been a lasting one. During the 1865 expedition in Wyoming, Dodge discovered a pass for the Union Pacific Railroad west of the Platte River. He resigned from the Army the following spring and, with the encouragement of Generals Grant and Sherman, became the Union Pacific's chief engineer in the renewed effort to build a transcontinental railroad. Some 11 million acres of public domain land were at the builder's disposal. Three rail companies began construction on a line connecting Council Bluffs with San Francisco. The Western Pacific labored on the Oakland-Sacramento sector. The Central Pacific toiled from Sacramento to Promontory Summit, Utah. And the Union Pacific laid track from Council Bluffs to Promontory Summit. The line extended 1,907 miles from the Great Plains across the Rocky Mountains to the Pacific Ocean. Dodge did not build the Union Pacific. He was in charge of surveying and selecting the route of the line. Yet his strength and command and sense of direction were the bedrocks of the effort. Men laid track all day, then returned to portable towns that every few weeks were dismantled, packed on trains, and moved. Stores, saloons, blacksmith shops, brothels, etc. to another site to keep pace with the advance of the rail line. The towns became known as Hell on Wheels. At the height of construction, Dodge suddenly found himself immersed in the greatest political scandal of the century. He supervised track location and laying for a company known as Credit Mobilier, in which Dodge himself had purchased stock. The company became involved in kickbacks, using routes to benefit its own landholdings, hiring subcontractors in return for under-the-table cash payments, and engaging in other acts of corruption. For a time, Dodge thought the firm was merely inefficient. "Like all roads," he said, "the line was managed 1,000 miles away, the mere plaything for Wall Street to be set up and down as a circus." Yet when the balloon burst, Dodge fled to Texas to avoid testifying before a congressional committee in Washington. Late in 1866, Dodge defeated an Iowa incumbent for a seat in Congress. He was rather inconspicuous during his one term because he still had his old job as chief engineer for the Union Pacific and often worked at the ever-shifting railhead. At the same time, Dodge tightened his political grasp in western Iowa in preparation for the time when he and his political colleagues would control the entire state. On May 10, 1869, the Transcontinental Railroad joined ends at Promontory Point. Dodge is a central figure in the now famous photograph of locomotives standing nose to nose. He had a prominent role in linking east with west and in opening a vast new area for settlement and national prosperity. The places where he first created stops during railroad construction, Dodge City, Cheyenne, and Laramie, are living monuments to his influence. He supervised a dozen different rail lines thereafter, with New York as his general headquarters. At one social affair, President Theodore Roosevelt told him publicly, "I would rather have had your experience in the Civil War and have seen what you have seen than to be President of the United States." On January 3, 1816, Dodge died of cancer. He had declined the offer of burial at Arlington National Cemetery in favor of being taken home to Council Bluffs. Dodge and the country matured in step. In 1851, when he went west, Illinois was still on the western frontier. When he died in 1916, the United States stretched from sea to sea. Dodge's railroad was a mighty leap in that evolution. George Armstrong Custer, A Flair for Disaster. No American officer has known a more meteoric rise and meteoric fall than George Armstrong Custer. Fact and fiction swirl around him still, and perhaps always will. What is well known is his tendency to charge first and think later. As a result, he became famous for the U.S. Army's largest defeat in the West. Ohio-born and named for a minister, Custer spent a stormy 3 years at West Point. He came close to expulsion each year because of poor grades and misbehavior. In addition, the illnesses he contracted ranged from diarrhea to gonorrhea. In the class of 1861, which was commissioned a year early because the Army needed officers, he ranked dead last. Allegedly, he was under detention at the time of graduation. He entered the Army as a cavalryman, and by the spring of 1863 had risen to company command. He was a protege of the Army of the Potomac's cavalry chief, Alfred Pleasanton, who promoted Custer in one step from captain to brigadier general. Besides being so young, Custer lacked the aptitude for command, nor did he look the part of a reliable general, despite being a broad-shouldered six-footer. Colonel Theodore Lyman, chief of staff to General George Meade, wrote at the time, "Custer is sight to behold, looking like a crazy circus rider. He had a faded velvet suit with tarnished lace trimmings, a little gray felt hat and long boots. His head is garnished with soft flaxen curls, and he has a devil-may-care blue eye, very appropriate to his style." No officer had more nicknames. Fanny originated at West Point. During the war, he was called Otty from a loose pronunciation of his middle name. Curly came from his ringlets, and Cinnamon was for the spicy hair oil he used liberally. Custer had a passion for dogs as well, and wherever he was camped, at least one dog was nearby. In battle, he was aggressive but foolhardy, gallant but reckless. His attacks were always heavy. So were his losses. Custer's capstone came at Gettysburg in a July 3, 1863 charge on the Confederate cavalry. The flamboyant Custer later reported, "I challenge the annals of warfare to produce a more brilliant or successful charge of cavalry." His February 1864 marriage to Elizabeth Libby Bacon was a milestone for Custer. She would become his greatest publicist. His rashness again surfaced on April 9, 1865 at Appomattox. While Lee and Grant were negotiating, Custer rode into Confederate lines and demanded that the Army of Northern Virginia surrender to him. A mini-battle almost occurred between Custer's troopers and General James Longstreet's infantry. At the end of hostilities, Custer was a 25-year-old brevet major general. He wanted to stay in the military, but in February 1866, the Army began downgrading officers who held brevet, temporary, rank. Custer suddenly found himself a lieutenant colonel, three steps below his wartime status. He took an extended furlough to consider his civilian options. In the end, Custer declined the colonelcy of the 10th Cavalry, the all-black Buffalo soldiers, and instead accepted appointment as lieutenant colonel of the crack 7th Cavalry. The American settlers pushing westward continually broke treaties and seized land, oftentimes aided by the Army. As resistance came from the native tribes, pressure arose to clear them out of the way. Custer joined in these efforts at suppression, but following his 1867 campaigns against the Sioux and the Cheyenne, he was court-martialed for taking an unauthorized leave to see his wife. General Philip Sheridan had the punishment ameliorated, and Custer returned to duty with a vengeance. His troopers gave him two more nicknames, Iron Butt and Hard Ass, for the stern discipline he levied. Ambition fueled his new resolve, yet he never quite understood Native American tactics. He and his men were to pay dearly for this fatal drawback. In November 1868, he was solely to blame for destroying an unoffending Cheyenne village on the Washita River. He explained his decision to Army Chief Sherman in this way. I have to select the season when I can catch the fiends, and if a village is attacked and women and children killed, the responsibility is not with the soldiers, but with people whose crimes necessitated the attack. Custer participated in a large 1873 expedition into the Yellowstone region. Following year, his regiment was part of a force dispatched to track down Native warriors in the Black Hills of the Dakotas. American soldiers and the tribes fought one another in the rough country for 2 years. Then came June 25, 1876, and the Little Bighorn. Custer had been ordered to take three columns and attack a large contingent of warriors in southeastern Montana. His force, in the center, arrived on the scene early. Instead of waiting for the support elements on either flank, and estimating there were no more than 500 to 600 enemies in front, Custer brashly galloped forward with 220 cavalry. Suddenly, some 2,000 Cheyenne and Arapaho warriors assailed Custer from three sides. Post-battle legend holds that Custer's men made a heroic stand on the side of a hill and fought to the death. Recent research has destroyed that myth. The Indian attack began at 4:30 p.m. and ended in a mere half hour. Bows and arrows were not used. Rather, the native braves were heavily armed with repeating rifles, while Custer's troopers were using single-shot carbines. There was no last stand. It was a running fight in which the men of the 7th Cavalry were routed, chased down, and slaughtered. All 220 troopers were killed, and the only remaining survivor was a horse. Custer's naked body was recovered 2 days later. He had been shot in the chest and the head. For a year, his remains were buried alongside those of his troops. The fame accorded to Custer came after his death. News of the Little Bighorn massacre did not reach eastern cities until July 4, 1876, the 100th anniversary of the nation. Overnight, the heedless Custer became a heroic soldier who had sacrificed his life for his country. Custer's body was reinterred with military honors at West Point. His widow, Libby Custer, spent the next 57 years writing three books and giving countless lectures glorifying her husband. The distribution by a national brewery of an intricate battle scene titled Custer's Last Stand added to the myth of the great martyr. Henry Wadsworth Longfellow wrote an ode. Theodore Roosevelt gave public praise. On the other hand, professional soldiers such as Grant and Sheridan angrily denounced Custer's recklessness. The Little Bighorn was the Army's most decisive defeat in the Indian Wars, yet it did serve to harden the mood of the nation. Thereafter, an all-out effort was launched to crush Indian resistance once and for all. As in the case of George Pickett, with whom he shared a number of characteristics, George Custer was destined to give his name to a military disaster. His rashness within the Union Army during the war could be controlled. Left to his own devices, however, he earned the reward of any military leader who acts before he thinks. Winfield Scott Hancock, Beloved Soldier. Dubbed Hancock the Superb early in the war, Winfield Scott Hancock looked and acted like a man born to command. He was named, as were so many men of that time, for the hero of the nation's first two wars. Two distinctions marked Hancock's war years. He was the longest-serving Corps commander in the conflict, and he never committed a major tactical blunder in the four-year struggle. A month younger than Stonewall Jackson, Hancock was born to a Pennsylvania minister lawyer father with strong Democratic ties. He was only 15 when he entered West Point, and he enjoyed the academy's discipline and the many friends he acquired with his genial personality. After he graduated in the lower third of his class, the Army became his life for the next 45 years, the last 17 of which were served with the 6th U.S. Infantry. Sickness and assignments kept him out of the Mexican War, and quartermaster duties did little to expedite promotion. For that reason, Hancock was only a captain when secession came. His closest friend was a Virginia colleague, Lewis Armistead, and their 1861 separation to different armies was emotional for both men. Hancock continued with the quartermaster department until his jump to become Brigadier General of Infantry. He attained fame in his first engagement, the May 5, 1862 Battle of Williamsburg, Virginia. General George McClellan praised him as Hancock the Superb, and the nickname stuck. To meet Hancock was to see all the attributes of a good officer. He was 6 feet 2 inches tall, powerfully built, and with brown hair and a military heavy jaw. He made a habit of personally getting to know every one of his field officers. In an army where leaders were generally profane, Hancock, with his full-bodied voice, was one of the best practitioners. U.S. Grant summarized Hancock as presenting an appearance that would attract the attention of an army when he passed. Promoted to Major General between the battles of Antietam and Fredericksburg, Hancock continually displayed what one called an inspiring fury in the hour of action. Offered command of the entire army on one occasion, he bluntly declined. He told his wife, "Give yourself no uneasiness. Under no conditions would I accept the command. I do not belong to that class of generals whom the Republicans care to bolster up." In the Army's 1863 reorganization, Hancock assumed leadership of the Veterans Second Corps. The pinnacle of his career came in July. One military historian has declared, "No other general at Gettysburg dominated men by the sheer force of their presence more completely than Hancock." On the critical third day's fighting, the Second Corps repulsed Pickett's charge. Among the dead was Hancock's old friend, Confederate General Lewis Armistead. The Virginian went down at the same time that Hancock received a permanently crippling injury. Hancock was sitting on his horse when a bullet ripped through the saddle pommel and entered his upper thigh, carrying with it pieces of wood and a bent iron nail. A surgeon extracted as much of the material as his fingers could reach. 3 months later, another surgeon managed to extricate the bullet, yet the large wound festered intermittently for the remainder of his life. Not until the eve of Grant's 1864 overland campaign could the Army's best corps commander return to duty. A soldier noted that in the first engagement of the campaign, fought in the wilderness of Virginia, Hancock's presence was itself enough to inspire the troops to deeds of unmatched heroism. For much of the fighting to the outskirts of Petersburg, Hancock rode in an ambulance. The Second Corps took heavy losses at Cold Harbor and Reams Station. By autumn, Hancock's wound had inflamed again. This ended his role in the Civil War. The military's regard for Hancock showed when he was assigned to oversee the trial and execution of the four Lincoln conspirators. It was an ugly duty, especially since the general did not believe one of the condemned, Mary Surratt, was guilty. In 1866, on Grant's recommendation, President Johnson placed Hancock in command of the Department of the Missouri, which included Missouri, Kansas, Colorado, and New Mexico. The general wished to pursue a moderate policy in negotiating with angry Cheyenne tribes. Hancock lived by the axiom, "My politics are of a practical kind, the integrity of the country, the supremacy of the federal government, an honorable peace, or none at all." However, shortly after arrival at Fort Leavenworth, Hancock led an expedition to negotiate with Cheyenne and Sioux tribes. The peace party got off to a bad start by burning, for no reason, an abandoned Cheyenne village in central Kansas. The mission ended with relations worse than ever. President Andrew Johnson, meanwhile, was embroiled in a personal feud with General Philip Sheridan. Late in 1867, Johnson transferred the volatile Sheridan to take Hancock's remote department, while Hancock was assigned to Sheridan's Louisiana-Texas district. Radical Republicans howled over Democrat Hancock's promotion. Hancock warned his friends that radicals will crucify me. I shall have Johnson's sympathy, but he is powerless to help me. Sure enough, the following year, Hancock was exiled to a virtual wilderness stretching from Minnesota to Montana. The general sought again to make peace with Native Americans. Yet a massacre of a Blackfoot band, plus settler encroachments in the Black Hills, in direct violation of the Treaty of Laramie, left both sides feeling contentious, with peace nowhere in sight. This unhappy period for Hancock ended in 1872 with the death of General George Meade. Hancock became the senior major general in the Army. The war wound continued to be periodically infected, and he slowly mushroomed in size toward 300 pounds. He was assigned to duty in the populous eastern states, which brought Hancock increasing attention as a potential presidential candidate. Supported by Northern Democrats, as well as Southerners who remembered his kindness during Reconstruction, Hancock became the 1880 Democratic candidate for president. His opponent, James Garfield, won by a scant margin of 7,000 votes out of 9 million cast. Hancock refused to ask for a recount. "The true Christian spirit," he said, "is to forgive and forget." In 1884, Hancock re-injured his bad leg and survived a large abscess. His last public act was to preside at Grant's funeral. A boil in the back of his neck developed into a carbuncle that resisted treatment. He died February 9, 1886, at Governor's Island, New York. His death certificate listed malignant carbuncle and diabetes as causes of death. He was buried in Montgomery Cemetery in Norristown, Pennsylvania. Hancock was an excellent soldier and gifted commander in the Civil War. Later, believing in the supremacy of civil over military government, he practiced a moderate rule in Reconstruction and paid a penalty for doing so. He seemed out of his element on the frontier and possibly too honest for high political office. Fortunately, Hancock the Superb is the image most remembered, and as a Union private in the Second Corps wrote, "One felt safe when near him." Philip Henry Sherman.